Welcome to Free Speech Bites. I'm Kirsty Hughes, Chief Executive at Index on Censorship. Free Speech Bites is our podcast series made in association with SAGE. In this series, Nigel Warburton interviews a number of leading figures about free expression and why it matters.
David Taylor is a biographer, novelist, and critic. I asked him about his free speech icon, a figure whose life highlights the importance of free expression. David Taylor, welcome to Free Speech Bites.
Good to be here.
Now, who is your free speech icon?
Well, as a long-term fan of his and his biographer, I'd have to say George Orwell, otherwise known as Eric Arthur Blair, which was his baptismal name.
In most people's minds, George Orwell is, through 1984, the staunch defender of freedom of expression and of the small guy against the state, as it were. Is that accurate about Orwell and his views on freedom of expression?
I think it's true to say that most of Orwell's professional life, large amounts of the things that he wrote, are to do with the suppression of the individual voice. There's that famous line of his where he talks about all the smelly little orthodoxies that are contending for our souls, and the idea that the real human being has to jump over these hurdles imposed by orthodoxy and autocrats. And of course, the last novel he ever wrote, 1984, follows exactly this theme. It's about a man who sits in an office doctoring back numbers of the Times newspaper, falsifying history so that what really happened is always being altered so the facts fit with the current pronouncements of the regime. Having said that, his view of free speech is by no means clear-cut. It's sometimes very nuanced. Well, he fought in the Spanish Civil War. He lived through the Second World War. And these were times when the whole freedom of speech issue became much more delicately shaded than it would otherwise have been. I mean, you have that whole problem. It's what I call the classic liberal dilemma. How far do we tolerate something that, if tolerated, will cease to tolerate us, which is the classic problem that the free speech advocate faces. If you are living in a democracy and somebody is putting out fascist pamphlets encouraging the end of that democracy, how much rope do you give them? And I think that's something which he was very conscious, particularly during the Second World War.
How did it manifest itself?
He essentially wasn't really a proper political writer, I would have said, until the second half of the 1930s. And before that, he fancied himself more as a novelist, I think. But he was very interested and, in fact, bequeathed a great collection of pamphlet literature, English historical pamphlets, over the centuries. And he collected a lot of these things during the Second World War. And there's some very interesting diary entries and pieces of journalism where he goes through the sort of things that he finds. And obviously many of the examples of pamphlet literature circulated in the Second World War can only be described as extremist. There we were fighting a war against fascism. There are Quaker pamphlets in favour of peace. There are fascist pamphlets in favour of some kind of accommodation with the enemy. And Orwell ruminates about these and thinks, is it proper, when we're at war with Nazi Germany, to allow people to circulate literature that opposes the whole idea of us being at war with Nazi Germany and is perhaps even sympathetic to Hitler? And of course, there were organisations like this about in the Second World War. I mean, there was a famous institution called the Reich Club that existed almost until the fall of France, which was blatantly wanted some kind of accommodation with Hitler, was run by a mad conservative MP called Captain Ramsay. I think Orwell was, as were a lot of his contemporaries, much exercised with the dilemma of how do you deal with these people. He wrote a very interesting article, an essay which is germane to all this, a piece about Salvador Dali called Benefit of Clergy, which is all about Dali's autobiography and his whole antinomian approach to life. And in the course of this, he makes two very interesting remarks. He says, short of the dirty postcards you used to be able to buy in Mediterranean coastal towns, there is an argument for not suppressing anything. On the other hand, he remarked that it's possible to say that, yes, this is a work of genius, and yes, it should also be burnt by the public hangman. And his point there, I think, being that no art is morally neutral. In other words, it has an effect on the people who are going to come across it, and the artist has a responsibility to think about that effect. You know, rather than just walking away from the mess he has created, you have to think of the effect that your work may have on people. So this is what I mean about the nuanced view. I think Orwell's view about extremist pamphlets during the Second World War and copies of Peace News being on sale at newsagents was that it was fairly safe to let these things be sold and read because they appeal to such a minority part of the population. If a few thousand people want to read the fascist case for opposing the war, then let them read it, because really it's not really going to be able to do any harm. I think that was his view. So it was quite a pragmatic approach, I think, to the whole problem of how do you treat your fifth column if you're at war with somebody.
That's really interesting, because it sounds from what you're saying that what nuanced means here is that you take each case on its own merits. You don't have a simple rule that everything should be published, there should be no censorship of the press, but you recognise that in isolated cases, although your heart is with freedom of expression, you may need to censor.
Yes, and I think what he also realises is that what on the surface may simply look like a freedom of speech issue, when you probe behind it, maybe something else. And interestingly, the very first published article, the very first thing that he ever set his name to, in I think either 1929 or 1930, which was an article about a French farthing newspaper that he'd come across. I think it was called Les Amis du Peuple, Friends of the People. And it was being sold, and in fact, it's really rather a sort of precursor of what's happening in the newspaper industry. And now it was a mass market French newspaper sold for a farthing. And Orwell sat down to consider what he thought about this, and his opinion was that, yes, here was this paper that was being bought by hundreds of thousands of French people because it was so cheap and attractive and had the kind of stories in it that they wanted to read. But he also diagnosed a plot by the proprietors of French newspapers to drive down prices, to get mass readerships up. And he thought that the consequences of this, of cheap mass market newspapers, would actually be a squeeze on minority interest, slightly more expensive newspapers, perhaps peddling rather unfashionable views. And so what on the surface was an extension of choice ultimately would be a negation of choice. Again, it's the old problem. You allow this thing, which on the surface looks wonderful and which people seem to like, but its consequence will be to actually reduce the number of options available for the free-thinking, free-speaking reader and writer. So that too creates a problem. What do you do?
I suppose what you do is what Orwell did, which was write about it, if you're a writer. It strikes me that as a writer, he was somebody who didn't shy away from unpopular views, from not quite fitting into the categories that other people wanted to project onto him in terms of left and right. Do you think that he ever encountered literal censorship himself?
Oh, Orwell did encounter literal censorship, sometimes in rather amusing circumstances. His novels were always getting into trouble with his publisher, Gallant, in the 1930s and having to have bits cut out of them. But the cutting was usually for fear of libel rather than Orwell having said anything politically or morally unorthodox. There are a number of sort of satirical remarks about the advertising industry in Keep the Aspidistra Flying, published in 1936, and Orwell swore to Gallant's reader that he'd been scrupulously careful not to take anything from real life, and then I think Gallant's press agents saw that what he put in fact, was simply cannibalising lots of it, and there would have been terrible libel problems if these things had remained in print, and so they had to be cut at the last minute, and Orwell was furious. But it's interesting because his novels, his early books generally, the first four or five books that he wrote in the 1930s, there are quite often incidents in them which, when you look at them closely, are freedom of speech issues. There's a very pointed scene in Down and Out in Paris and London, whose 80th anniversary we're just getting ready to celebrate. Orwell makes friends with a screever, you know, a pavement artist. I think Bozo, I think his name is called. What he does, he's quite a superior practitioner of the art and draws satirical cartoons. There'd been an immorality case in Hyde Park, or an importuning case, you know, with the police acting as agent provocateur. And so the screever draws this cartoon of the park and the policeman, and the caption is, "Puzzle, spot the policeman." And Orwell says, "Sure, it would be much more to the point if you'd have put, spot the immoral conduct." And of course, the screever doesn't dare do that, because he then knows that the policeman will come on and simply erase the pavement drawing with his boot, basically. But there's a really rather shocking scene in Clergyman's Daughter, his second novel, where the heroine ends up teaching in this terrible private school in West London, in Ealing or somewhere, in the 1930s. And they're all the children of ferociously moralistic nonconformist parents. And she reads Macbeth to them. And they get to the line, "From his womb untimely ripped." And someone puts their hand up and says, "Please, miss, what's womb mean?" And so she gives them a little basic lesson in reproductive science. And is then denounced, and the parents turn up. They are so shocked that the fact of life may have been taught to these impressionable children that they all turn up, and in the company of the headmistress, just denounce her on the hearthrug. You feel immensely sympathetic towards Dorothy, the heroine, because she's simply trying to do her best. There's a sense of a vengefulness and a kind of sense of people being oppressed by other people's unreasoning attitudes. And this all, I think, connects to the whole tendency of Orwell's fiction quite long, long before 1984, and 1984 is the sort of cumulative effect of this. They are all about solitary individuals being oppressed by extraneous factors, by other groups of people, by having opinions that they don't necessarily want foisted upon them of their own opinions and urges, not ever being able to get out of that. There's a great sort of sense of paranoia, of being watched. I think this has a lot to do with Orwell's own slightly peculiar personality as much as that. But it's interesting how the free speech issue gets tied up with all of this, you know, in an almost ideological way.
Is there some triggering incident in his childhood? Was it his time at Eton or his prep school that you think got him going on this free speech thing? Or was it just that he became passionate about a cause that really matters?
I think it's a combination. Orwell had a very peculiar personality. And to go back to your first comment, there's a very interesting essay called Such Were the Joys about his time at prep school. And the school is envisaged as a kind of police state with informers and the headmaster as this eavesdropping figure who will always know what you are doing, who spies everywhere. And if you go out to buy a bar of chocolate at the sweet shop, someone will look at you and see your school cap and possibly report on you. So nobody's quite worked out when that essay was written. There's a kind of chicken and the egg thing here, and several people have speculated that it gave rise to 1984. And my own view is that they were probably written at the time when Orwell was thinking about 1984. And certainly O'Brien, one of the central characters in 1984, is described as looking like a schoolmaster at least twice. It's almost impossible to work out the causative link between the two, but I think that both artifacts were existing in Orwell's mind at the same time, and each feeds off the other is probably an accurate description. But in terms of his getting specifically interested in the suppression of truth and fact for political reasons, I think that the experience of fighting in Spain had an enormous effect on him in 1937. He always remarked that it was Spain that had actually made him a socialist, that after he'd been to Spain, everything he wrote had to be on the side of democratic socialism. And he said that, I think it was in Spain for the first time that he saw newspaper articles that he knew bore no relation to the things he'd seen, where he read stories about troops being denounced as cowards whom he knew had fought bravely. And the whole idea of, as long as you were in control of a printing press, anything could be said if you thought that it was appropriate. I think that was quite a formative experience, fighting in Spain, in terms of his view of the world.
And it strikes me that the most powerful expressions of his views about freedom of expression actually occur within fiction. That although he's a fantastic essayist, I don't remember essays where he's arguing for freedom of expression, but there are moments, particularly in 1984, which resonate for anybody interested in questions about the limits of toleration, the limits of a police state, surveillance and so on.
In his non-fictional writings, I think the idea of freedom of speech is more or less a given. It's when he dramatises it in fiction itself that it gets its resonance.
We know that Orwell was a great champion of freedom of speech. Was he always consistent? Did he encourage freedom of speech for others all the time? Or did he ever clamp down on what they wanted to say?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it could be argued that, albeit in an indirect way, there was one particular incident in Orwell's life towards the end where he was trying, more or less, to suppress other people's right to say things. And this is the famous question of Orwell's list, the list of communist or alleged, very in some cases highly alleged, communist fellow travellers that he supplied to the International Research Department, which connects to the Foreign Office, at the behest of a friend of his who worked there in the late 1940s. And all kinds of people appeared on this list, people like J.B. Priestley, and some of whom would now be regarded as quite mainstream. But there were also some quite extreme Labour MPs on that list. The actual basis of this was that the IRD was in the process of commissioning people to write pamphlets and literature aimed at those European countries which seemed to be in danger of falling under Soviet domination, which was what was happening, obviously, once the Iron Curtain had fallen in the post-war era. I remember Celia Paget, her name was, who encouraged Orwell to produce this list of names, saying that the problem was, and it was a very serious problem at that point, that such were the complexities of left-wing politics in the late 1940s, that it was very, very difficult to separate a left-wing Democrat from a Stalinist apologist. And there were apologists for Stalin in the House of Commons. Now, I remember the late Professor Sir Bernard Crick, another Orwell biographer, telling me he was very friendly in the 1940s with the sister of Ian Mikado, distinguished Labour Party figure, Labour MP for Reading in the 1945 Parliament, and Mikado's sister said to Crick, circa 1947 or 8, "Of course, Mick's got two cards, you know." Now, that meant that this Labour MP was also a member of the Communist Party, secretly and was presumably taking his orders from their headquarters in King Street as well as from Labour Party central office. Now that, to me, 65 years later, seems completely shocking. But this is the kind of thing that Orwell had in his mind when he was compiling his list. And as Celia Paget put it to me, in not in so many words, but this was her meaning, that this may sound paranoid and delusional and oppressive in terms of saying that no. But she said that at that time, it was very important that if you were going to have these pamphlets written, they should be written by sympathisers. And she said, this was a time when, if I looked down the corridor, sitting running the China desk in the next office was Guy Burgess. That was the kind of difficulty you were labouring under. And I remember discussing this with Michael Foote, who was edited Tribune when Orwell wrote for it. And Foote said that this was the great problem of being a left-wing politician in the 1940s, was that you could sometimes not slot that proverbial cigarette paper between a Stalinist and a Democrat. It was so difficult to work out. And so, he may have sort of overstated his case on a lot of occasions, but this is why he was so keen on identifying people who shouldn't be asked to do this because of the damage they might have caused. So you could argue there that this is an attempt to suppress people giving their opinions, but then you could also say that the opinions they were going to express would have just have in some way reflected the Communist Party line from King Street. I suppose in the same kind of terms, it's interesting to note that Orwell does seem to have certainly believed in the idea that something could be blasphemous, although being Orwell in a rather curious way. In fact, there's a wonderful, rather funny letter, in fact, that he wrote to Malcolm Muggeridge, I think dictated to Sonia in the autumn of 1949, his second wife, because he was so ill. And he thanks Muggeridge for the present of a pair of socks. And these were Woolsey socks, and they had a particularly distinctive advertising campaign. And he says to Muggeridge, I was really charmed to get... Muggeridge also sent him some books as a wedding present. And he said, I was really charmed to get these very rare books with their lovely illustrations. And at the end, he refers to it, encloses a magazine advertisement for Woolsey socks, which says, fit for the gods, but the god shown as a Greek god. And he says, I think you will agree that this, in a way, really blasphemous. Really, please come and see me, Thunes. Thank you so much again. Yours, George. And so... But it's not what we would regard as blasphemous. It's got Zeus or someone, you know, wearing a pair of socks rather than God or Jesus or something. But as I say, Orwell did in some ways have a very curious view of the world.
Don't you think that was an ironic joke?
In some ways, I don't think it was a joke. I think he genuinely did think it was blasphemous. Orwell had a sense of humour, but I don't think it was made manifest in things like that. I think he was genuinely shocked by this. As many people have pointed out, his sensibility was essentially Edwardian. I think it was his friend Richard Rees said of him that he was a conservative in everything except politics. So I think this too colours his view of the freedom of speech issue and the right to self-expression in any circumstances.
Now, you've immersed yourself in Orwell's life and thought. Do you think he got it right most of the time on these issues of free expression?
I think he did, because he thought, or he believed, that there was no real argument for the suppression of virtually anything, but there were questions of appropriateness, and there were questions of responsibility, and there were questions of the opinion of the majority not being outraged, all of which things are important in a democratic society. The idea that you can't just behave outrageously and presume that people are not going to be offended. Do you remember that there was that heavy metal band, Cradle of Filth? There was a row about 10 years ago. They're offensive. The Jesus is a cunt t-shirt, that's right. And the vast majority of liberal-minded people would probably say that it's not appropriate to walk into a public place wearing something like that, because the offence caused to the vast majority of the people who see it is probably more important than your right to wear something that expresses your own views about something or other, and that there is a collective right there that is more important than an individual one. And I presume that would have been Orwell's take on this kind of thing.
David Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For more information about Index on Censorship, go to www.indexoncensorship.org.